It is my distinct pleasure to introduce tonight's very, very special guest speaker, Dr. Gianfranco Bertoni. He is an associate professor at the University of Amsterdam, where he investigates topics at the interface between particle physics and cosmology. He has held teaching and research positions at Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, the University of Padova, and the University of Zurich, before going back to Paris and becoming a permanent CNRS researcher. In 2011, he joined the new Center of Excellence of Gravitation and Astral Particle Physics at the University of Amsterdam, where he leads the group supported by a prestigious European Research Council starting grant. He's the editor of a book called Particle Dark Matter, Observations, Models, and Searches. He's the editor-in-chief of the journal Physics of the Dark Universe. And he's the author of a popular science book, Behind the Scenes of the Universe, From the Higgs to Dark Matter. Tonight, he's here to take us deep into the mystery of dark matter. Please welcome Dr. Gianfranco Bertoni.
Thanks a lot, Greg, for this very nice introduction. Thank you for the invitation to the Perimeter Institute. It's really a great pleasure for me to be part for a few days of this vibrant community around the Perimeter Institute. As promised in the title of the presentation, which is also the title of the book, what I would like to do tonight is to take you on a journey behind the scenes of the universe. And in particular, I want to tell you about dark matter, which is my main subject of research. Dark matter is one of the main discoveries of cosmology in the 20th century. And we will discuss a little bit what the evidence for this unknown, mysterious component of the universe is, and what are the theories that have been put forward by scientists to explain the dark matter in the universe. Before starting, however, let me tell you in one slide what is the key idea, and then we will dive in the dark side of the universe. So think about an astronomical image that you've seen recently. You know, we are quite used to see images like the ones shown in this slide. These are like things like galaxies, or you know, supernova remnants, or planets, or stars. All these objects, all these images, and in general, all this extraordinary show that is offered by the cosmos, cosmology tells us that it takes place on a huge stage, which is made of something truly mysterious. And in particular, we call, because it doesn't emit any light, we call this mysterious matter that constitutes the scaffolding of the universe. We call it dark matter. Let us start this journey to the dark side of the universe with something familiar. What you see in this image is the night sky. Some of you who are familiar with the night sky will recognize the constellation of Orion here. And if you just move left from the belt of Orion, you will find the brightest star in the night sky that you can observe from these latitudes, which is Sirius. Sirius is a bright star, and it was studied by a number of people throughout the history of astronomy. And in particular, the position of Sirius in the sky was tracked by, you know, a very famous mathematician and astronomer whose name was Frederick Bessel. And some of you who worked in engineering or in physics recognize this name, because this is the Bessel of the Bessel functions that we currently, that we commonly use in our science. So this guy started to observe the position of Sirius, and he even went back to check. He was doing this in 1844. He went back to 1755, and he was comparing the position of Sirius, the position that Sirius had in 1755 with the position that he had at different epochs, 1767, 1800, 1806, and so on. And what he noticed is that This star was showing a proper motion, so a motion relative to the other stars, which was a bit funny and quite unexpected. So what he wrote in this article was that if we were to regard Procyon, which was another star that he was studying, and Sirius as double stars, their change of motion would not surprise us. So basically, by looking at the motion of Sirius, by looking at how Sirius was moving with respect to other stars, he could he basically suggested the existence of an unseen partner of Sirius, a smaller star that was too dim to be observed. And he even says something which is very interesting for people like me who to study dark objects in the universe, dark matter in the universe. He says something which is which really anticipates most of the revolutions that will happen then in the 20th century. He says, light is no real property of mass. The existence of numberless visible stars can prove nothing against the evidence of numberless invisible ones. So what he's thinking about is he's suggesting that there are the stars we see, but there are probably many others that we don't see. This may seem kind of obvious, and maybe it is in the sense that if you take a star and move it far away from you, it will become dimmer and dimmer until it disappears, unless you have a telescope which is powerful enough to follow it to larger and larger distances. So it is quite obvious that there must be objects out there that we cannot access with our telescopes. But he's the first one to use Newtonian dynamics, so the laws of gravitation, to infer the existence of dark objects in the sky. And 20 years later, a small companion star, which is called, which was called the Sirius B, was actually discovered. This is a Hubble Space Telescope image of this system, and you see Sirius A, the very bright star, and this little tiny dot here is Sirius B, the small companion, which we now know is a white dwarf, a very compact star. In fact, this particular white dwarf, Sirius B, has a mass which is comparable with the mass of the Sun. But this mass is concentrated in a volume, which is basically the volume of the Earth. Okay, so a very, very dense star. A few years later, there's another example of objects, like invisible objects, whose existence is inferred from some observed anomalies in the motion of known planets. And this is probably something that at least some of you will have heard about. This is the story of the discovery of Neptune. Astronomers like Urbain Le Verrier and Jean Couch Adams in 1846 discussed the orbit, the deviations of the orbit of Neptune from the predicted orbit. And they've shown with mathematics that was a bit more sophisticated than the one you needed to infer the existence of a companion in this double system, double star system that was Sirius. They were doing basically what is called now perturbation theory. They were studying how the existence of other planets beside the planets that were known there, they were influencing the motion of Neptune. And they've shown, actually, that the motion, the deviation of the motion of Neptune from the predicted orbit could be explained if a new planet existed. And just by brute force, they've calculated the mass and the position of the new planet. And they've brought these predictions to astronomers. And eventually, like actually only 1 year after the prediction was made, the planet, we're talking about Uranus and Neptune, it was discovered precisely within 1 degree from the position of, from the predicted position. And what François Arago, who was the director of the Observatory of Paris, said back then was that Monsieur Le Verrier saw the new planet at the tip of his pen, so with the power of calculation, rather than with the power of observation. Now, Interestingly, only a couple of years later, another anomaly was noticed in the motion of another planet, the planet Mercury, which is the planet which is closer to the Sun in the solar system. And in particular, it was observed that the perihelion of Neptune, so if you want the position of this ellipse of the orbit of Mercury, was precessing, was moving around as time passed by. And so of course, they had perfect control at that point of the planets of the solar system. You know, Urbain Le Verrier knew exactly how to calculate the orbit of Mercury, but there was this discrepancy they couldn't explain. And of course, you know, he was they had already discovered one of the planets he had predicted. He predicted a new planet that was supposed to be between the orbit of Mercury and the Sun. And they even gave a name to this planet that was dubbed Vulcan, actually. But this planet was never found. There were some hints of observation. Some astronomers in different countries started to see some objects transiting over the surface of this, the Sun. But the planet Vulcan was never detected in any convincing way. And when Albert Einstein came up with his theory of general relativity, it became clear that the explanation of the orbit of Mercury had nothing to do with the existence of new planets. But this peculiar motion was due to the fact that Newtonian gravity does not describe correctly the interactions between Mercury and the Sun. Einstein, with his theory of general relativity, came up with refined laws of gravitation that modify Newtonian dynamics. And this new theory actually allowed to explain the motion of Mercury. Now, this is very important for what we are going to discuss, because in what happened, let me just fast forward now to the 1970s. There's a lot of interest in history of science in the intervening century. But I want to go to move on to what we are doing today, the exciting stuff that we are doing today. If you have questions about the history of dark matter, feel free to ask. I'll be happy to discuss that with you. But let me now go to fast forward to the 1970s. What happened in the 1970s is that people started to consider systems like galaxies, like external galaxies. And the one you see here, many of you will recognize it. This is M31. This is Andromeda, our sister galaxy, very similar in shape and in size to our own Milky Way, the galaxy we live in. So, you know, you can, of course, admire the beauty of an object like this, but you can also try and apply some mathematics and physics to it. In particular, you can calculate what is the velocity of objects that go around that move around the center of the galaxy. And just by using some simple Newtonian dynamics, you can show by setting the centripetal force equal to the gravitational pull of the mass contained within a gravitocentric distance r, you can show that the velocity of the stars orbiting around the center of this galaxy must obey this, must be equal to the square root of g, Newton's constant, the mass contained within the radius r, divided by the radius r. Okay? So this is the familiar expression that we use to describe the velocity of planets in the solar system. If you just set the mass equal to a constant, and you know this is a very good approximation in the solar system because most of the mass of the solar system is concentrated in the Sun. So if this is a constant, then the velocity is just proportional to 1 over square root of r, and this is what you observe for the planets in the solar system. So when you try to apply this law to a galaxy like Andromeda, what you expect is something like this. You expect the rotation curve, so the profile of the velocity as a function of distance, to grow initially, because contrary to the case of the Sun, As you move from the center of the galaxy to the edge of the galaxy, the mass contained within the radius R increases. But then when you go beyond the edge of the disk, you expect this mass to remain constant. So again, you would expect first a rise and then a fall off, like one over square root of R, just like in the solar system. And this was the common expectation when people started to perform these measurements, but observations have shown something strikingly different. These are the observations of rotation curves of different galaxies. And what you observe is that in all these systems, there is an initial rise, as predicted by this simple law. But then you see that the rotation curves basically do not drop off for any of those systems. Now, if you want to interpret this, you have two possibilities. The first possibility is that there is some form of matter out there that you do not observe. And actually, you can, just by the fact that this rotation curve remains constant, you can actually infer that this must be a mass that increases linearly with radius. So this really means that there should be a lot of mass out there in order to explain these rotation curves. The other possibility, so this type of approach would be a type of approach like the one of, we discussed in the case of Neptune and Uranus. So you postulate the existence of some new forms of matter to explain an anomaly in the observed motion of celestial objects. Another possibility is that instead of new matter out there, this relationship is wrong. So the mass is basically not, so the velocity does not obey this law because Newtonian dynamics is violated for some reason out there. So this is the kind of dilemma that you have in the field of cosmology. And it is, I think, important to realize that although in principle these two hypotheses at this level are more or less on the same ground, there are tools in cosmology to discriminate between these two possibilities. And let me spend a couple of minutes to tell you how this can be done. In order to do this, we make use of something called gravitational lensing. And basically, we go back to Einstein's theory of general relativity and his famous Einstein equation. Some of you will have seen this already. What this equation tells us, basically, is that the geometry of space-time, which is encoded in this mathematical formula here, is basically set equal in this equation to the matter and energy content the portion of space-time that you're considering. So in particular, if you have a concentration of mass, space-time around it is distorted. Okay, so if you have a light ray that is propagating near this distribution of mass, it will not follow a straight line, but it will bend because space-time is distorted around this this object. And this type of effect was already predicted a long time ago, shortly after Einstein's theory of general relativity was proposed. But we now regularly observe systems which exhibit very strong distortions. There's one system in particular that has become very famous in cosmology, and it is the one system that allows us to visualize the difference between the prediction of the dark matter explanation of missing mass in the universe and a modified gravity explanation. Let me show you with this series of images what this is about. So this is an astronomical image, and those with a trained eye will recognize that there are some there's a concentration of galaxies actually in two spots in the sky. But instead of doing things by eye, what you actually do in cosmology is you run a particular algorithm that allows you to reconstruct just by the way light is distorted by this concentration of mass, it allows you to reconstruct what is the mass of these objects that are distorting background images. If you perform this standard procedures, you come up with something like this. You see this blue clouds here and here. They show where the mass in these systems, in these two clusters of galaxies, is concentrated. Okay? It's here and here. Now you can perform another observation. You can ask, where is ordinary matter in these systems? Ordinary matter, which is the matter we are familiar with, in objects like galaxy clusters, is typically in the form of gas. And this gas, actually, is relatively hot, and it emits a peculiar radiation in the form of X-rays. So to see where ordinary matter is, you can perform an X-ray observation. You take your X-ray satellite, you point it to a system like this, and then you can construct a map of where baryons, so ordinary matter, are. If the dark matter hypothesis is correct, you expect the position of baryons to be slightly offset with respect to the distribution of mass. And the reason is that, whereas dark matter is basically collisionless, so two clusters of galaxies can go through each other without interacting at all, the gas in these systems will exhibit a substantially different behavior. And we know what, this is standard physics that we know how to describe very well. You have these big clouds of gas, they go through each other, so inevitably they will develop some peculiar features like shocks that you would observe in X-rays. So in the case of dark matter, you expect an offset between the position of of ordinary matter and dark matter. In the case of modified gravity, you expect ordinary matter and dark matter and the bulk of the mass in the system to lie exactly on top of each other, for the very simple reason that in your theory, you don't have anything else that seeds your gravitational potential. So all the mass is in the form of these baryons, of this ordinary matter, and they must therefore lie on top of each other. When people performed observation, X-ray observations of this object, they observed this. And what you see here is that there is you can perform a statistical analysis, actually, of a map like this, but it is quite obvious by eye that the centroid of this distribution of mass is substantially offset with respect to the position of the ordinary matter, which is concentrated in these red clouds. So observations like this is the so-called bullet cluster, because this is, this small cluster actually has gone through the bigger one and has developed this peculiar shape. This is due to the shock wave produced in the gas as it went through the big cluster, and it has the shape of, more or less, the shape of a bullet. Observations like this tell us that the dark matter hypothesis is actually more convincing, and it allows to explain a wide range of astrophysical and cosmological observations with respect to theories of modified gravity. We can discuss more if you're interested in the question session about what is the status of theories of modified gravity, but for the rest of this talk, I will assume that dark matter is different, that dark matter exists, and it is different from ordinary matter. Now, beside gravitational lensing, we can also perform all sort of other astrophysical and cosmological observations. And so, for instance, we can look at, as we say, the rotation curves of galaxies. We can look at clusters of galaxies. And we can even look at the so-called cosmic microwave background. In fact, just by looking at the cosmic microwave background without knowing anything about what happens on the scale of cluster of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, you can get convincing evidence for dark matter just by looking, by studying the statistical properties of the cosmic microwave background. And the picture that emerges is really disturbing, I would say. This is the matter budget of the universe in modern cosmology. So this is not like a crazy idea people are trying to discuss now, trying to improvise on observations. This is basically textbook cosmology. In textbook cosmology, in the what is currently referred to as the standard cosmological model, only 1% of all the matter in the universe is in the form of stars, you know, the stuff that we see when we look up at the sky. Only 1% is in the form of stars. There's another 7%, which is in the form of gas, in what we call virialized structures. And by virialized structures, I mean objects like galaxies, like the Milky Way, or clusters of galaxies, and so on. And then there's another 7%, which is in a more diffuse form, which is what we often refer to as the warm-hot intergalactic medium. And then, and so basically, all this 15% is accounts for all ordinary matter. So all the matter which is made of nuclei, so the same stuff that makes us and the planet we live in, and as a matter of fact, everything we see around us, including stars and astronomical objects. 85% of the mass in the universe is made of dark matter, something we don't know much about, beside the fact that it must be substantially different from anything we've ever measured in our laboratories. So you can see this in two ways. This could be considered as the ultimate principle of mediocrity, as someone likes to call it, which is to say, you know, this is the ultimate Copernican revolution, you know, that we've progressively been displaced from the center of the universe to a very common place in the solar system. We're not at the center of the galaxy. What this is telling us is that we're not even made of the same stuff that makes most of the universe, right? You can also be more optimistic and call this the ultimate principle of excellence, because what this is telling us is that we are really special in a way we could never have suspected, right? So when you think about a galaxy, so this is how an astronomer used to think about a galaxy until 20 or 30 years ago. When neo-cosmologists talk about galaxies, they have in mind something like this. Okay, so they have in mind a disk of ordinary matter, of stars and gas, embedded in a much larger and much more massive distribution of dark matter. Now, as I say, this is textbook cosmology, but until we go out and measure these particles, you could think that this is, you know, what I'm telling you is just, you know, fairy tales. You know, it's you know, stuff we come up with because we don't know how to explain things. And my impression is that current observations strongly point towards a scenario of this type. But in order to be convinced that we are on the right track, we need to be able to measure the existence of these particles, of these dark matter particles. Otherwise, this will remain just a conjecture, the existence of dark matter. So let me ask the question, what do we know about these dark matter particles? And I will not go through all the properties that are known for these dark matter particles. Let me just mention the first three, because I think they are, you know, easy to be explained in a short time. The first property, so if you ask particle physicists whether they can come up with extensions of the standard model of particle physics that would explain dark matter, you know, particle physicists are very creative people, but you can ask them to postulate the existence of particles that satisfy a number of criteria. The first and foremost criterion is that these new particles must satisfy the constraint on the abundance of these particles in the universe, We can measure with, in particular with the cosmic microwave background, we can measure the abundance of dark matter particles in the universe with a good precision, with an accuracy of about 10%. So if you want to propose the existence of a new particle, you must be able to explain why you have that particular amount of dark matter. Dark matter particles must be cold. So in particular, they must be non-relativistic particles. This, in maybe too simplistic terms, because there are possible caveats to that, it means that they must be heavy enough, with a mass much larger than the mass of a proton. And they must be neutral. So they cannot have an electric charge. They cannot have a color like quarks. They cannot have any of the charges of the standard model. So if you just further consider all the properties here, you basically rule out all the particles of the standard model. All the leptons, the quarks, all the gauge bosons, everything is ruled out by this type of observation. So what we know about dark matter, and I think we can confidently say, is that it must be different from anything we've seen so far. So when you ask what are the possible dark matter candidates, most people will tell you that the most interesting dark matter candidate is a particle whose name is the neutralino, that arises from theory, from super, so-called supersymmetric theories. We will discuss some of these, some details of the supersymmetric theories later on, when we discuss the connection with particle physics, and in particular, the type of searches that you can perform in accelerators. But the list of candidates that have been proposed in the literature is actually longer than that. And I told you that particle physicists are very creative people, right? So this list could go basically on forever, okay? So sometimes if you just randomly open up a book of, like a journal of astroparticle physics or cosmology, you know, you feel like you're looking at one of those old maps where, you know, ancient geographers used to place, you know, monsters. So this is a map, for instance, that was drawn in 1260 and is conserved at the British Library in London. Well, this is, you know, a very different map. This is a world map, which is quite different from the ones we are used to see. This Jerusalem is at the center, and all the continents are arranged around it. And you see that, you know, where there was the so-called terra incognita, where there was which was basically unexplored land, based on like distorted accounts and myths, geographers used to place these monstrous creatures, stuff they had heard about, stuff they had invented in some cases. We are also looking at, you know, sort of terra incognita in science. We're looking really at the frontiers of science, and you know, we want to figure out what is out there. So we're coming up with ideas about what could be out there. And our only hope is that just like some of these mythical creatures, these monsters that were described in bestiaries, this is an example where you have an elephant and a dragon. And for a person living in the Middle Age, you know, they were, you know, equally likely to exist. So our hope is that just like some of these creatures turned out to be somewhat distorted perceptions of real animals, we hope that, at least with our theories, we get close to what dark matter could be, so that we can construct experiments to search for these particles, which is the equivalent of, you know, going out there, going to Africa, into India, and to search for animals like that. So I've shown you this long list of dark matter candidates. Let me simplify things a little bit. Most of the candidates I've shown, and most of the candidates people work on these days, fall in the very broad category of WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, a very nice acronym that was invented by Michael Turner in the 80s. The basic idea is the following. I told you that, you know, the first criterion, and you know, maybe the most important for new particles to be considered viable dark matter candidates, is that they must fulfill there must be a physical process by which these particles achieve the appropriate abundance in the universe, which is measured. So this is something we can compare our theories with. And in this broad class of candidates, the appropriate abundance in the universe is achieved through processes of this type. You have two dark matter particles that annihilate two particles of the standard model. So you have two dark matter particles colliding and they are transformed into particles of the standard model. And this, in the very early universe, this process would be at equilibrium. So think about a chemical reaction where the reaction can go in both directions. You have dark matter particles turning into ordinary matter turning into dark matter. But there is something interesting that happens if the strength of this interaction, so the probability that these two particles collide and are turned into particles of the standard model, if these interactions are at the weak scale, so the weak scale is a particular scale in particle physics. You've heard, I'm sure, the term weak force in physics. If these particles are have interactions at this scale, they would, what would happen in the universe, as time goes by, the density of these particles would initially drop off exponentially as long as these particles are kept in equilibrium through these reactions. But at some point, depending on the strength of this interaction, which is parameterized by this quantity called the annihilation cross-section, as time goes by, since the universe is expanding, the number of interactions of these particles with each other goes down by a lot until, at a certain point, they freeze out, which means that these particles basically cannot find each other anymore. This process cannot appear, it cannot happen anymore. And the number of particles, of dark matter particles in the universe, basically remains constant after this very first instance, right after the Big Bang. If you think of dark matter particles as particles having weak interactions, you can produce them in the early universe in a very natural way. Okay? This is why WIMPs have become so popular. And the interesting thing is that for completely different reasons, so this is something that cosmologists came up with, people concerned with the dark matter in the universe. Particle physicists who were studying elementary particles in accelerators, they also were studying similar theories. And in particular, in order to solve some of the most fundamental problems of particle physics, like the hierarchy problem, the fundamental distinction between bosons and fermions, and so on, they came up with theories that actually predicted the existence of particles that really looked like WIMPs. They really looked like weakly interacting massive particles. So they basically predicted the existence of particles. They were just perfect dark matter candidates. And these particles basically came out as a bonus from their theories. They were not trying to solve the dark matter problem. They were trying to do something completely different. So what we hope actually is that by finding new physics at the weak scale, so by finding weakly interacting massive particles at accelerators and in other astroparticle experiments, we could solve at the same time some fundamental problems in particle physics and the dark matter problem in cosmology. In order to do that, we need to perform experiments. Otherwise, again, this is just these are just nice theories, but they remain at the level of conjectures. And I will spend the last 20 minutes of this presentation telling you about the experiments that we are currently running in order to search for dark matter particles and to prove the so-called WIMP paradigm, so the fact that dark matter particles are related to the weak scale in particle physics. There are three types of searches. One is searches at colliders, so in particular at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Then you have direct detection. These are experiments which are placed deep underground and the search for the interaction of dark matter particles with the nuclei in the experiment. And then you have indirect detection that is typically performed with satellites or ground-based telescopes. This is something that keeps a lot of people busy these days. This is a map of the experiment that are being performed right now all around the planet. Let me show you briefly what are the most interesting ones. So you have experiments, like dedicated experiments, which are shown in red. And they are typically placed in deep mines. There's Homestake and Sudan mines. There's one also in Canada, 5 hours north from here. And then a number of underground laboratories in Europe. And then you have also some in China and in Korea and in Japan. For what concerns accelerator searches, there was until recently Tevatron, the big accelerator at Fermilab near Chicago. And now there is the Large Hadron Collider at CERN near Geneva. What I want to do now is to briefly go through these three types of searches, just to give you an idea of how one can try to measure and to prove the existence of these objects we know of these particles we know very little about. Let me start with the so-called indirect detection. The idea here is the following. I told you that dark matter annihilates to ordinary matter. And in particular, dark matter can annihilate to any particle of the standard model, including photons, including electrons and positrons, anything. I'd also told you that on average in the universe, these annihilations have become very rare. And this is why this density has become constant, because these annihilations, on average, they don't happen anymore in the universe. But it so turns out that the annihilation rate is actually proportional to the square of the density of dark matter particles. So even if, on average, in the universe, they happen only rarely, if you look at regions where dark matter is concentrated, where the density is very high, then the annihilation rate can be also very high. So a number of us have studied what is the predicted flux of photons. Actually, the photons you get out of this annihilation process have an energy which is comparable with the mass of these particles, which is typically of order 100 times the mass of the proton. And photons with an energy of 100 GeV, which is the unit for the energy of the mass of these particles converted to energy, is of order, it's 100 GeV, which is the typical energy of gamma rays. So what you can do is basically, and a number of us have played this game, you can calculate how much radiation, how many gamma rays, how many photons you predict from different directions in the sky. So this is a full sky map of the predicted emission of photons produced by the annihilation of dark matter particles. This is a full sky map in galactic coordinates, which means that the galactic center is right at the center of this image. And what you see here is that there is the strongest source of photons is expected to lie exactly at the center of the galaxy, because right there you have this big concentration of dark matter. And then you have a number of other sources here and there, which correspond to substructures of dark matter in the halo of the Milky Way. And what is interesting is actually that there was this press release just last month. This is a NASA press release. And what you see here is a zoom in towards the center of the galaxy. And most of what you see here is basically the standard emission that we are familiar with. But if you really zoom in the innermost region of the galaxy, there's a sort of a glow of gamma rays, which is currently unexplained. So all astrophysical sources we have been able to study and towards the galactic center, they cannot account for this excess emission that is produced right there. So of course, we are still far from claiming that this is evidence for dark matter. But I think this is something that deserves to be followed closely, in particular if the same type of glow that we see from the center of the galaxy can also be seen from other structures like dwarf galaxies or other objects in the inside the halo of the galaxy we live in. Let me move now to direct detection. And the idea here is slightly different. So we consider a physical process in which two dark matter particles are turned through an annihilation process into particles of the standard model, ordinary matter. Here we are looking at a slightly different process. You build a detector, and you basically, so the idea is the following. You build a detector, and you wait for a dark matter particle to enter your detector and to scatter off a nucleus in your detector. And what you measure, since the dark matter particle would then be with that continuous journey, what you want to measure is the recoil energy of the nucleus which has been struck by a dark matter particle. Now, in principle, this is easy to do. In practice, it has taken decades of hard work for experimentalists to reach a sensitivity level with these experiments, which allows now to probe interesting regions of the parameter space of the new theories that particle physicists have proposed. Let me show you with this video how one of these experiments in practice works. So this is experiments like Xenon 100 and LUX, which are the experiments which are the most sensitive worldwide. The idea is basically they have a vessel, which is this big, that contains a liquid xenon, which is a very heavy nucleus. And there's a liquid xenon part in the bottom and a gas xenon in the upper part. And then you have an electric field, which is applied. When you have a particle with an electronic, electroweak interactions entering in the detector, you ionize some of the electrons from the nucleus. And when the electrons are drifted up and they end up in the gas, they produce a flash of light. Okay? So you have two ways of checking the collision, one with the first flash of light and one with the second one. If you have a dark matter particle interacting instead of a standard model particle, what happens is that fewer electrons are produced in the ionization process, and the flash of light that is produced when the electrons go up and they reach the gas layer on top of the liquid, this flash is less intense. So by comparing the intensity of these two flashes of light in their detectors, experimentalists are able to discriminate what is called background noise, so all these uninteresting particles that go through your detector, from particles that look like dark matter interactions. So the status of the field is that, there have been a number of claims of detection, and if you're interested, we can discuss that. But basically, all these big experiments, like LUX and Xenon 100, have found nothing so far. So the only thing they could do was basically set an upper limit on the interaction strength of dark matter particles with ordinary matter. Okay? And this is, of course, very interesting because this allows us to constrain our theories. So there are some of our theoretical predictions are done here. And in this plot, I'm showing you the strength of the dark matter interactions as a function of their mass. And this is what we stand now, more or less. These are incredibly small scattering cross sections. And these are, again, the theoretical predictions. These experiments have ruled out interactions above, interaction strength, which are above this line. So as you can see, they've started already to constrain our theories, our predictions. When new experiments will become available, you will be able to go all the way down and to rule most of the parameter space, most of the predicted solutions for suggested solutions for the dark matter problem. The last detection strategy I wanted to mention is searches at colliders. And probably many of you are familiar already with the layout of the Large Hadron Collider, which is right below the border between Switzerland and France, near the city of Geneva. there's this 27 kilometers ring where particles are accelerated. And along the ring, around this 27 kilometer circumference, you have these detectors like ATLAS and CMS, in which these particles, these beams of particles, collide. And by analyzing the outcome of these collisions, you can search for new particles. It is the same idea that has led to the discovery of the Higgs boson a couple of years ago. Now, in this video, you see how this actually happens. You have protons that are circulated into smaller rings, smaller accelerators. There's a booster, the proton synchrotron, the superproton synchrotron that accelerates these particles up to 450 GeV until these beams of protons are circulated in opposite directions along the big circumference of the Large Hadron Collider. And here we are following the journey of a proton. We will enter now into the beam pipe. We just passed the border between Switzerland and France. And so you have, in this visualization, you have these three quarks inside the proton. And then you have these protons that then eventually they collide right at the center of this, you know, enormous detectors that are, you know, bigger than this theater, right? They are like 50 meters tall, 45 meters long, and, you know, densely instrumented. And the goal of these detectors is to track all the particles that are produced in the collision between the protons. Now, to simplify a bit what happens, let me tell you in a nutshell how particle physicists help to extend the standard model of particle physics, so I can tell you how you can search for particles like WIMPs in an experiment like the Large Hadron Collider. What you see in this plot, actually, is all the particles of the standard model, all the particles that have been discovered, the elementary particles that have been discovered so far. You have, on the right, you have the quarks, and, you know, the up and the down quarks are the ones that you typically find predominantly inside protons. Then you have the leptons, the electron, and the heavy cousins, the muon and the tau. And then you have the corresponding neutrinos for each of these leptons. And then on the left, you have the gauge bosons, so the particles that mediate interactions. And with the discovery of the Higgs in 2012, basically, the standard model has become textbook physics that you can put on your shelf, and basically, it gives you a satisfactory explanation of every experiment that has been performed on Earth, with the possible exception of neutrino masses, but then you can just do a minimal extension of the standard model to explain that. Now, in these new theories, in theories like supersymmetry, for instance, what happens is that for every particle of the standard model, you have a supersymmetric partner. So each particle has its own supersymmetric partner. And in the jargon of supersymmetry, to each quark, you associate a scalar quark, or squark. To each lepton, you associate a lepton. And then you associate also partners to the gauge bosons. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at what happens here when you estimate the properties of the partners of the gauge bosons, you end up with something which is, you know, with particles which we call neutralinos, which have just the right properties to explain the dark matter. Okay, their mass and their interactions are just the mass and interactions you would like to you need in order to explain the dark matter in the universe. So how do you search for these particles in your detectors? Basically, what you do is, as we said, we smash together beams of protons. When you do that, what you can hope is that if the energy of these protons is high enough, you can produce these particles up here, for instance, you know, these partners of the quarks. That are typically much heavier than the quarks themselves, so you really have to accelerate these protons to very high energy in order to produce them. And then what you can do is to basically, you can basically follow the decay chain the decay of these particles from quarks all the way to the lightest particle of the new theory, which is, in most cases, the neutralino. Okay? So you start from a very heavy particles will decay into lighter and lighter particles until you reach the neutralinos, which are the lightest particles of this new theory, and these particles cannot decay into anything else anymore. So they will just fly away from your detector without interacting with anything at all. So the way you detect these particles is by producing squarks, following the decay chain. You collect all the particles of the standard model that are produced when you decay from these heavy particles to the light ones. And then you will the idea is that you may discover neutralinos because they carry away energy from your detector. So when you reconstruct the energy balance of the collision, you will find that there is an imbalance in a given direction, which is the direction corresponding to the trajectory of the neutralino. Okay, so this is how you can hope to search for these particles. And you know, starting from next year, from 2015, there will be a new run of the LHC, which has been run at an energy of 7 TeV. Now the energy of the next run will be much higher, will be almost twice the energy. It's going to be probably between 13 and 14 TeV, the energy of these beams of protons. And we hope that there will be enough energy to produce these particles and observe processes of this type. Now, we need to be to ask the question of whether we are on the right track or not. And there is this old saying attributed to Confucius, which says, "It is difficult to search for a black cat in a dark room, especially when there is no cat." Right? So we need to be very careful. And what I want to argue in the last 2 minutes before concluding is that whatever we find in all these experiments, it's going to be real scientific progress. And in order to do that, let me show you an example of a null experiment that proved to be incredibly important for the history of science. This is the so-called Michelson and Morley experiment that was performed in 1887. Back then, physicists were really convinced that light and electromagnetic radiation was carried by an invisible substance called the ether. Okay? But then these two experimentalists tried to measure the velocity of the Earth relative to this ether. And they had this nice apparatus, this nice interferometer that they had built. And to cut a long story short, they had this nice prediction that the experiment, as they would rotate the experiment, the pattern of the fringes of the interferometer would move in a sinusoidal fashion. This is the prediction. And their measurement was the black line here. So clearly not consistent with the prediction. But even more importantly, in order to show this line here, the experimental line here, they had to multiply it times a factor of 8. Because otherwise, just by looking at it, you would have guessed that this is just completely flat. There is no effect whatsoever. So of course, people try to save. Whenever there is this, whenever there are beautiful ideas, people always try to save them by adding some epicycles to that. But it was still interesting. So this is what someone called the great tragedy of science: the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis by an ugly fact. But the important thing is that even the failure to find the predicted behavior and the properties of the ether as they were predicted, this stimulated the ideas of many other physicists, and eventually with Einstein's theory of special relativity, people could get rid altogether of the idea of ether and just move on. But perhaps the other possibility is that WIMPs will be found, And you know, just like the Higgs boson, perhaps we just need to try harder than we have done so far. And the last thing I want to ask before concluding, I'll just take 1 minute for this, is to ask the question is, what happens if they are found? My impression is that if WIMPs are found in any of these experiments, we will be in a situation like this very nice ukiyo-e. This is a Japanese print that tells a story which is very famous in different cultures in Asia, in which there are these six blind men which are asked to tell what an elephant is. And, you know, they are touching different parts of the animal. Each of them is touching a different part of the animal. And some say maybe it's a pot, maybe it's a brush. And actually, in this, when Buddha sees this, he says, how they cling and wrangle, some who claim for preacher among the honored name, for quarreling, each to his view they cling, such foresee only one side of a thing. So the idea is that with only one experiment, with only one class of experiments, it's going to be extremely hard to figure out what dark matter is. But by putting together different experiments, this can be done in a much more satisfactory way. So I had some slides to show you this in much more detail, but since I've already spent 1 hour talking, I will stop here. And if you're curious, just feel free to ask questions. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
All right, so here's dark matter. It's massively important for the evolution of the universe. And you showed us that gamma ray picture. This is a worldwide race. What horse do we bet on? Who's winning?
I wish I knew. So my impression is that infrared detection, like this glow of gamma rays from the galactic center, cannot be as convincing as other types of evidence. So in particular, there is this glow that is compatible with some of the dark matter candidates that we've discussed for decades now. But the point is, how do we convince ourselves that this is the right explanation? And my impression is that unless we observe the same type of emission from other objects, like dwarf galaxies, for instance, in the Milky Way, it's going to be very hard to be convinced that we have identified dark matter. So, it's hard to say, who will get there first, but I think that finding new particles in a collider will be just, as spectacular as it gets.
I have two questions. So the first question is, are they using the same detectors to find neutrinos as they are dark matter? Like the exact same detector? Are they using different detectors with similar purposes and setups?
They are different detectors. You have to tune the detectors to the type of particles you're searching for. There's one class of detectors which is useful both for neutrinos and for dark matter. And that's these are the I've briefly shown this on the map. This is the ice cube experiment at the South Pole. And that experiment actually, which is right at the geographic South Pole, and that experiment measures high energy neutrinos. They go they actually go through the Earth and they produce muons in the detector. And one interesting prediction of these models, of these WIMPs scenario, is that these dark matter particles, since they have interactions with the particles of the standard model, as they stream through the Earth and the Sun, they can be captured by these big objects and sink at the center. And one can perform a calculation of what would be the fate of these particles. And the outcome of all this is that these particles would concentrate at the center of the sun, they would annihilate at the center of the sun, And then any particle produced in the annihilation would be captured. But neutrinos, since they have very, very weak interactions with ordinary matter, can escape the sun and they can reach us. So seeing high-energy neutrinos from the sun would allow you to measure, you know, high-energy neutrinos, which it would be already quite spectacular. Actually, Ice Cube has measured now high-energy neutrinos, but they have nothing to do with what I'm describing now. And the evidence for annihilation of dark matter particles at the center of the sun.
And the second part to the question was, how do you think dark matter will interact with black holes?
Right, that's an interesting question, actually. So the way individual particles would interact with the black hole itself actually would be the same as for standard matter. This is just a purely gravitational process. But black holes actually have interesting effects. The growth of black holes has interesting effects on the distribution of dark matter. You can think about the system like, you know, think about a two-body system like the sun and the Earth going around it. So suppose that at some point you start to grow the mass of the sun, and you want to, and you study what happens to the orbit of the Earth. So what happens if the growth of the sun is on a timescale which is much longer than the orbital time of the Earth around it, is that the orbit of the Earth will shrink because of the larger and deeper gravitational well. When black holes form, so they typically start from a small seed, and then they grow to the size of the supermassive black holes that we see at the center of galaxies. This has a very dramatic effect on the matter that surrounds them, like dark matter. And dark matter cannot shed away energy like baryons would do, like emitting light and things like that. So they would just create these very large concentrations of dark matter, and this has interesting consequences, for instance, for the annihilation rate that you predict from the center of galaxies.
Is there a proven or theorized opposite of dark matter?
Say it again, sorry?
Is there a proven or theorized opposite of dark matter?
What do you mean by opposite?
Opposite, like...
Like anti-dark matter?
Yes, anti-dark matter.
Right, yeah.
As you can say.
Yeah, so for in the case of... So take a diagram like this one, for instance. So you see, what typically happens in this annihilation process is that a dark matter particle can annihilate only with an anti-dark matter particle. It turns out that if you study supersymmetric theories like any particular neutrinos, these particles are their own anti-particles. So we just give them a name and we say the two neutrinos interact with each other. But they have the same type of, type of physics that ordinary matter has. So they can, in principle, have charge, they can have antiparticles, and so on. Then you have to run the observational constraints to rule out possibilities.
Is there any evidence that dark matter is spinning with the planets in the universe? Rotating?
There is one thing I can tell you, which is because I think what you're asking is, for instance, if I take an object, let me actually show you a little movie, because maybe this will allow you to visualize how dark matter evolves in a system like the Milky Way. So the short answer to your question would be that typically you don't get really large net rotation of these dark matter halos. But take a look at this. This is how a galaxy like the Milky Way forms in modern cosmology. So basically what happens is that you have small halos of dark matter that merge into bigger and bigger structures. Just follow this one, for instance. You see that this enters. And because of tidal stripping, you see that it sheds a lot of its matter in the host galaxy. And you know, through this process of merger of many of these small halos, the big halos are formed. So you know, if these halos formed by the direct collapse of of very big halos directly to halos like the Milky Way, then you would expect this rotation to be very large, because you know, even if it was a little rotation when they are collapsed, the angular momentum would be very large. But because of that, the net rotation is typically very small.
Why are supersymmetric particles heavier than their standard model counterparts? Shouldn't they be symmetrical? And that's from my IT guy, _ Adam.
Yeah, so that's... So in principle, so when you write down supersymmetric theories, if supersymmetry was a perfect symmetry, then all the particles of the standard, all the supersymmetric particles would have the same mass as the particles of the standard model, as their own partners. But because actually we know that there isn't such a thing as a supersymmetric electron at the energy at a mass of 511 kV, we actually have to ruin the beauty of the symmetry and break supersymmetry at a certain scale. And that's why these particles cannot have the same mass, actually.
Perfect. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Gianfranco Bertone.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Thank you.